Hello? I think I'll stand. I can see you better. Hello, everyone. Nice to meet you all. So tonight's theme is about sound. Yes? So I understand most of you are Buddhists, or you are studying something in Buddhism, and or practicing some kind of perhaps chanting, meditation, studying sutras, etc. So I would like to tell a story about when I first started to practice, and hopefully this will give you some idea what it means. When we do some kind of practice, how we open our mind. So, actually, when I first started practice, the very first thing I ended up doing, kind of by accident, was doing a 5-day, very intense Zen retreat. And we were sitting for many, many hours, no standing up, no, cannot move, very strict. We say, just keep Huadu, what is this? And at the end of that retreat it was in England when I was living there and working. The Korean monk who led this retreat gave us a tape of his Dharma talk. And I took this tape home and I started to listen. It's the first time I sort of listened to a Dharma talk. You know, he was giving a talk like a lecture, something like this situation. And in the middle of the talk, he would stop and then he would recite, chant the great Bharani. Daibejo? Yeah, say Daibejo. It's a long mantra, yeah? Long, takes about 5 minutes maybe if you chant. And we in Korea, we use the moktak, you know, the wooden bell. So we chant Shinmyojangudedarani Namoradana, like that. So anyway, this venerable would chant one dharani, then stop. Then he would continue his Dharma talk. And so I would listen to this whole thing, and later then he would also chant maybe the Heart Sutra, and then also continue his talk like that. So he would break his talk with a little bit of chanting. But somehow this Dharani chanting, I never heard it before. And it really caught my attention. So I would listen to the whole, that time it was still a tape. No YouTube. It was a tape. I was playing it in my Walkman. So every day I'll go to work in the morning, take the subway. And that was my chanting time because I couldn't really chant in my room with my roommates. I couldn't make noise. So I would put my earphone, then I would listen to all the chants, the Three Jewels, you know, Heart Sutra, and then I would listen to this Dharma talk, and I would listen to this great Dharani, and I would replay only the great Dharani part over and over and over. I was getting obsessed with this sound of the Dharani. It was every syllable was going in, going in. And I don't know what it is. What is this song? And I don't know how to find it because it's in Korean and I don't know where it comes from. So I keep listening, listening for a few months, and then this tape finally got so stretched out. It got so worn, and the whole thing sounded, you know. So I destroyed the tape, but finally I had to go to Korea, and then I went to a bookstore. And when I was passing by, before I could go into the bookstore, there was a cover of a book cover, and it said, "From Harvard to Hwagesa," the name of this book. So, Harvard University, you all know Harvard University? Yeah. So, it was written by a monk in our school, Hyeonggak-sanim, about his personal journey of finding the Dharma and becoming a monk. He was a student at Harvard Divinity School, and then he went all the way to Hwagesa, the temple where Zen Master Sungsan was teaching. So I saw this book, I thought, very interesting. I took the book. I read it in 2 days, and then I went to Hwageza, and I applied for Kelche. But it was almost the end of winter Kelche, and they said, you can't join now, it's too late. You can join next year's Kelche. So I had to wait one more year. But that time, it was interesting how this book appeared in front of me. Because at the very moment I saw this book inside my head, I had this thought, I have to find some group of people that I can practice with. And somehow this Dharani was taking me there. So the first thing I could do was then come back to London, and then I went to a retreat in the Paris Zen Center. Then in the evening we were doing chanting. And in the middle of the chanting, suddenly everyone was chanting this great Dharani. And then boom, this is it. The rhythm was a little different. But it was this, I was like, what is this? What is this mantra? What is this sound? So it was the great Dharani was what Zen Master Sung San was chanting for 18 hours every day for 100 days when he got enlightenment. And that was his practice throughout his whole life until he passed away. So when this, when I realized this, it was really kind of a big wake up. How this sound go into my consciousness and how it worked on me subconsciously, how I could recite it. I kept wanting to recite it. And then finally, it was like a compass that just kind of took me and allowed me to find my sangha and my teaching that would help me. So fast forward about 15 years, and I was at the Providence Zen Center where we were doing a winter retreat. And every day in the evening, we will chant the Heart Sutra in English. Korean and also in English. And every day our practice is exactly the same. Same practice. Bowing, chanting, sitting, eating, working, walking, then bowing, sitting, chanting. Kind of boring, right? But one day we were sitting and chanting the Heart Sutra in English. And as we were chanting this line, no emptiness, nothing to attain. And as I was chanting these lines in English, suddenly I just felt this, like nothing was there. Only the sound. Only the words in English. And the words in English appear very clear. But who was chanting? This thing that was chanting, there was nothing there to chant. There was no person there. There was this moment of the chant, the sound, the person, all was one. And it was a bit of a shock because I couldn't feel my body, but I could hear the sound. And I was aware that the sound we were making was all one with the whole group of people chanting together. Then I understood, oh, nothing to attain. This is it. Very interesting. So there are words. We can chant our calling the Buddha's name, Namo Amitabha. We can chant Kwan Seum Bosal. We can chant Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. We can chant the great Dharani. We can even recite sutras over and over. So what does that do for us? First, actually, if we look at it from a scientific point of view, vibrations in our brain are affected by sound. That's very easy for us to understand, right? If you play music, the vibration of your brain waves follow a rhythm. So when we hit muktak, when we hit the bell, that sound, actually, when it's done very smoothly in a nice rhythm, it creates relaxation. We call that entering the delta wave. Delta wave is a state of our brain which allows us to have relaxation, and it usually happens in very good deep sleep without dream, or in a state of very relaxed and healing meditation. So that's wonderful, but that's not everything. Why? Why Heart Sutra tells us no attainment and nothing to attain? But at the end of Heart Sutra, it says, Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. What is that? What is Anuttara Samyaksambodhi? So when we chant, any kind of chanting, any practice you do, the most important thing is the direction of your chant, the purpose first. Why? Why do you chant? Why do you read sutras? What for? So many of us might like to ask Buddha for help. That's okay. We might chant for our families, for ourselves, for something bigger perhaps. Perhaps our community, somebody who's suffering. But Zen Master Sungsan has taught us that the bigger you make your vow, the greater your compassion and your wisdom will grow. So we have a vow, it's called the Four Great Vows. And the first vow is to know that, first of all, sentient beings are numberless, so we vow to save them all. It's a very great vow. It's set up as a paradox. Sentient beings are numberless, but we do vow to save them all. So the direction of our chant, if we can have this direction, it includes not only our families, our community, our loved ones, but it includes all beings, including our enemies, the people we don't like, okay, situations we have difficulty with. If we include all of that in the whole universe, then our great vow is the compass of our practice. It's the compass of our chanting. So it's really important. It's a lot like if you take an airplane. The airplane goes from Kuala Lumpur to New York. Does it go in a straight line? No? Yeah. It's the earth is round, so this airplane goes in a curve, right? But you feel like you're going in a straight line. But the airplane is programmed by its computer. The trajectory is set. So that's save all beings from suffering. That's our direction. It's our life after life vow. Doesn't matter this life, next life, doesn't matter. Our direction, the course is set. Okay? But each moment, every split of a second, the airplane has a program because it's actually going straight. Then it's angling two degrees further south, 2 degrees further east, 2 degrees further west. So it keeps readjusting its course every second or nanosecond to reach this destination. So our life and our practice is like that. Many times it's zigzagging. But this program requires a password. So that password is Namo Amitabha, Kwan Sen Bodha, or whatever it is your practice you do, moment to moment to moment to moment. Then this sound, Kwan Sen Bodha, this sound, Amitabha, is the button you can press to become clear right here, right now. It's like a butter, very smooth butter, and you put a knife, very sharp knife, cut right through very smoothly. So moment to moment, Nami Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Kwan Sen Bodha, moment to moment to moment to moment in our life, let our mind open. But It doesn't work as easily as we all think because we forget our password. So you're familiar with that. You forget your password, right? On your phone, on your computer. So our only problem is not that practice is difficult. That's actually a lie. The only problem is we have forgetfulness. We have not so good memory. So forget to come back to right here, right now. Okay? So moment to moment, what are you doing right here, right now? So anytime you repeat this Namayamitabo or Kwansen Bosal, who is repeating that? What am I? Who is repeating Namayamitabo? For what? So you have to always course our practice in this direction, a clear direction. Then you'll get a result. Okay? So everyone, thank you for coming here. I'm very grateful to Chenwen Sinim for inviting me here and having this opportunity to share with you our practice. And I wish all of you to find your true self and save all beings from suffering, because this world truly needs bodhisattvas to help many, many suffering people, not only people, but this whole planet. So thank you for your training and your sincere effort. And I'm very grateful to this beautiful society here that continues to study and practice the Dharma. Thank you.
Thank you, guiding teacher Kathy Park. Now, let us invite Zen Master Siong Hyang to share with us. But before that, let me read her biodata. Zen Master Siong Hyang, Barbara Rhodes, or Bobby, as she is known to many people, was one of Zen Master Siong San's first American students and began studying with him in 1972. She was given inca or permission to teach in 1977 and received Dharma transmission from Zen Master Siong San in 1992. For many years, Bobby worked as a hospice nurse, and her practice and teaching was profoundly impacted by sitting with her patients as they transitioned from their bodies. Today, Zen Master Siong Hyang is the guiding Zen master of Kwan Yam School of Zen, which includes over 100 centers and temples worldwide. Let's put our palms together and welcome Master Zen.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. I'm really here to answer questions. Kathy gave the Dharma, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have. Are there any questions? Maybe, okay.
Excuse me, please use the mic, we are doing recording.
How do you attain enlightenment as a layman?
I'm a lay woman. That's how I attain enlightenment. What is enlightenment? It's a very important point. You know, we're all here, and all of us, including myself, we have always have more to learn. Always have more to learn. And as Kathy mentioned, you know, asking what is this, having curiosity is a very, very important element in Buddhism. And we know Shakyamuni Buddha had a big question. He's always looking for a better practice, something more powerful, something. He would do these very ascetic practices and have complete 100% effort, but always felt some thread, some confusion, something that didn't feel complete, as the story goes. And he finally just sat down under the Bodhi tree and asked, what is this? What am I missing? What am I? What is this? Something like that. He was definitely asking a question. So even the thought of enlightenment, we should question that. Well, what is enlightenment? What is that? So I really want to stress tonight how important it is for you, each of you, to realize that you are already the Buddha. We saw in the very beginning, she said, everybody's a Zen master. Well, really, nobody's a Zen master. To master Zen would be complete, in my mind, it would be complete compassion, complete wisdom. It would be Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 hands, 1,000 eyes. This beautiful Buddha downstairs, is it in the, just 1,000 hands behind the Buddha, Avalokiteshvara. So that means you can see in every single direction. You can feel, you can care about this infinite sentient beings in every single situation. How are they doing? How can I help? What is this? Now that sounds exhausting. That sounds impossible. It sounds, how could I ever do that? But you start with just asking, how are you doing? How am I doing? Like, what's the point of my life? What am I doing here? I always had this question when I was young, like, before I was born, where did I come from? When I die, where do I go? I truly had that question. I think many children have that question, wondering, like, how did I show up here? What's the point? And I think for myself, I would see a lot of phoniness, a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of anger, a lot of greed. Even as a young child, children are very sensitive. You know, you just kind of, like, you can feel like this doesn't feel so great. This doesn't feel so great. Well, what's the point? So that doesn't have to be depressing, because you can also have a good time. You can enjoy your life. You can have good friends, good food, enjoy learning, enjoy sports, enjoy everything. It's no problem. But still, all of us, I think, in this room have this curiosity about what am I? And I just really want to encourage you, to each of you, to know that, to believe in yourself, to trust that question about what am I or what is this. And as Kathy said, it's like this airplane. You know, it's off course. It always is readjusting. It's impossible to always be on course when you're in the elements. You know, the airplanes and the wind and the altitude and the thinness of the air, it makes the airplane very, very vulnerable. And we're all vulnerable. But what's not vulnerable is that radar, you know, and that intelligence. And so we have to take our intelligence and shoot it towards understanding ourselves, understanding enlightenment. So Zen Master Sung Sang, for me, was a wonderful teacher. I was, you know, I met Zen Master Sung Sang before a lot of you were even born. You know? I don't feel that old, but I guess I'm getting old, you know. It happens. But it's like, what surprised me so much about him was that he said, you can do it. He kept saying, you know, you have to believe in yourself. You can do it. What are you? And then he taught us the koan practice. He taught us how to return to zero, how to have that empty mind, and then to listen, moment to moment to listen. So again, it's not this long enlightenment. It's this instant enlightenment of, oh, that's it. Oh, that's it. Oh, that's it. So a koan practice is very, how do you say koan in Chinese? I don't know. You know what I'm talking about, koan? Kangan? Yeah, okay. So it just gets you to go, what? Not negative what, but just what? Curiosity. And that's our grounding force. If it can come from here, even if we're on a busy street, or we're in a family tragedy, or we're in a movie theater, a great movie, but we're asking, what is this? How is it? Pay attention. And then our mind opens, and we take in more. And again, as Kathy said, this wisdom, this compassion enters from here. You know, we have to open up with curiosity, with paying attention. You must know this story about there was a practitioner who was, I think it was a monk, a Buddhist monk, who was sweeping. He was sweeping the grounds, and he swept up a pebble, and the pebble hit a bamboo fence, and it just went tuck. Just simple, just an ordinary sound of the pebble hitting the bamboo. It wasn't special, but his mind at that time was clear. It was asking. It was practicing. It was sincere. It was steady. So then he had this opening, this awakening, by just hearing that one little sound, ordinary sound. And many people express that it just took a sound. And it's not a special sound. It's like your mind was receptive. Your mind was questioning. It was awake. And this is not work. This is refreshing. So I think some people think that, you know, you're bearing down and you're practicing like that and nothing else is important. It's just, and it's the opposite of that. You're open. You're receptive. You're being kind. You're paying attentive. Maybe you're just being confused. You're doing your best and you're confused. Something's too complicated for you. It's too tense for you. It's too, just too complicated. And so you're in a confused state. You could still get enlightenment in that confused state if you're open. So it's not a positive thing. It's not a negative thing. It's an attentive thing. So I always feel like a cheerleader. Like, I just want you to know that you can do it, you know. You know, it's not complicated. And yes, it does take some training. But there's many examples of lay people who practiced. And their training was very ordinary, very steady, very simple. And maybe they never heard of Buddhism. You know, but they just tried. I there's one quick story. It's kind of dramatic, but this person was living in India, and I don't know how many, could have been 100 years ago. I don't know when it was. It's a wonderful story, though. And he was in a very low caste, the lowest of the castes in a, I don't know if he was a Muslim or Hindu, I don't know, but his job, his grandfather, his father had been butchers. They had to kill cows. And in India, that's a terrible job. That's like the very disgusting, not respected job. But he was following his path, his correct situation with his family's roots. And he hated this job. And back then, the way they killed a cow was with a big, big hammer. And they would swing it and very carefully hit the cow right in the spot on their forehead where they would lose their consciousness, lose their life. But he felt so much mercy for the cow, for the animal, each one, that every time he did it, he was as careful and as strong and as clear as he could possibly be with each of those impacts. Totally focused, because then he would talk to the cow, he'd be peaceful, he wouldn't let the cow feel any fear, and then without the cow seeing, boom, and then the cow would pass. Just boom. And he got very, very, very good at that, whereas the cow wouldn't know what hit him, have no idea. So as the story goes, it's a very short story, he just, one day he was doing that, and just as the sound of the hammer hitting the forehead of the cow, he burst open with an awakening experience. He woke up, he got enlightenment. And it's so funny, because it's not funny, but so amazing. He was doing a horrible thing, and he woke up. And I like that story, because we think we have to be holy, or we have to have a higher caste, we have to come from a higher caste, or have some kind of advantages in order to enter into a practicing situation. But he was practicing. He was exactly practicing. Mercy, compassion, strength, accuracy, attentiveness, sound. So very ordinary and yet very extraordinary. And one time someone asked the Master Sung Sung about a mantra. Oh, it's very hard for me to pronounce Om Mani Padme Hum or something like that. It's difficult. He goes, oh, no problem. A very wonderful mantra is Coca-Cola, 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 Coca-Cola. And I never forgot when I first heard that. Coca-Cola. He said, oh, that's a good sound. It flows. You know, like Kwanse and Bosol, that flows, you know. And I just laughed so hard. It was like, Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola mantra. Because it's not holy. It's being awake. It's being simple. It's believing in yourself, opening up. So truly, you could just do Coca-Cola. We have, you know, it's Coca-Cola. So sometimes people don't want, you know, they don't. And in America, I was born in the time when the hippies first, the hippies in the United States in the 60s, in the early 70s, that's just when I was, the late 60s, early 70s, I was a hippie. And we're the ones that started the Whole Foods movement in America. Because we were really turned on and we made whole foods. We made soups and breads and stopped using, you know, we used only whole grains and organic foods. And within 7 years or something, it caught on. And we started with this big company, Wonder Bread, that was always white bread. And all of a sudden, Wonder Bread started making whole wheat bread. And it felt like such a success. Like, wow, even Wonder Bread has made a whole wheat. So I thought, well, everything's going to get better. Everything's going to keep getting better, you know. But it's like, no, because each person has to see why, what. What is wholesome? What is it? Do you love yourself enough to put something wholesome in your body, not just for the taste, but for the energy and the clarity that it gives you? And not all of us love each other enough. And so a lot of these bad habits persist. We don't love each other enough. We don't believe in ourselves enough. And that has to come from, again, your question, what am I? Don't just accept some miserable life or some miserable job or miserable relationship, but wake up and see how you can shift into a positive, growing place. And we all have that opportunity. Just if that man killing the cows could do it, you can do it. So any questions? Come on, it helps if you ask a question. Yeah, yes.
We feel easy to practice when we don't have any challenges. But when it came to the turbulence of the life, it's just like what the master said, that we forgot the password. Even for that short moments, how do we recall these passwords? I mean, the practice that to recall ourselves.
Yeah.
How to get back to the track?
You have to suffer.
To shorten the timings.
Yeah. So we say a bad situation is a good situation. A good situation is a bad situation. So in the past, I've had many friends that had been given a trust fund. They had wealthy grandparents, wealthy parents. And, oh, my grandchild, you know, and they put a whole bunch of money in the bank. And when the child's 18, they can start to draw out this money. It's a lot of people, it's plenty of money for the rest of their life. So every month they can take out $7,000, American dollars, or $5,000, whatever they need. Oh, I want to go to Miami. Oh, just buy a ticket. No problem. Everything is easy, materially easy to purchase. But all of those friends, I didn't have that many, but, you know, maybe five or something that I've known through the years. They're miserable. They're not happy. They're very confused. They're wandering around. And the happy ones, when, as a nurse, the lower the job, like the harder they had to work, they were the people that were the happiest, you know. The nurses' aides were happier than the nurses because they were right hands-on with the patients. You know, they were just had to work hard to get food on the table for their children and have a crummy little car they had to take care of and simple life. They were actually often more happy than the higher paid nurses. You notice it. They're checking less. There's paying They're just simple, having lots of friends with a coworker, lots of fun with the coworkers, and when I would be with a family, when I would get a new assignment for a family as a hospice nurse, I would get their chart and their address before I would go to visit them. And if they were in a lower class neighborhood, I'd be happy. I'd say, oh, they'll be easy to work with. You know, they'll listen to the nurse. They'll be grateful. And the ones with more money, they were, one family made me go in the back door. I've never been so insulted in my life that, you know, I was a servant that had to enter through the back door. And it was like, what an attitude when someone's coming to help you with your comfort, with your pain, you know. Oh, you're just a nurse, you know. Well, that's a terrible way to live when you have these attitudes and these opinions. And so often those people aren't so happy. And so, of course, there's many wealthy people that are very happy, very generous, very kind, many. But it's that whole thing, if you have to struggle a little bit and you really have to see where your food comes from and pay attention to who your friends are and how to help your children, it's you're more awake. You've got that question again. You're fresh. You're alive. Why do you think the monks and nuns have such an ascetic practice? They're simplifying, 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 and less is more. And that's become a cliche in America. You know, less is more because your life's more simple. That's all. So, what did you ask me? Oh, how do you go back to your roots? Yeah, you simplify your life and you remember your roots. You know, there's too much materialism, obviously. There's way too much materialism. So if you simplify and grow your own food, grow some of your own food, pay attention to your children. You know, notice who's suffering, who's not. Notice if there's some way you could comfort somebody. That's simplifying and going back to your roots the way it used to be. You know. Any other questions?
Zen Master, I have this question. I have spent time with friends and relatives who were in their dying days. And when they, in their last hours, they seem not to be aware of their surrounding. And we were taught, as Buddhists, we are taught to say, to chant or to do some practice for them. But actually, I actually didn't know, or I really doubted whether those things actually helped. And in your experience in hospice care, how did practice help these people?
Well, first you have to understand what practice is. And as Kathy said, it's vibration. You know, it's sound, like sound. If you practice with sound, as I said, it could even be Coca-Cola, it's vibration that you're soothing your mind. You know, it's not internal or external, but it's actually vibration. So I told this story in Singapore. It's kind of an outrageous story, but one of my patients that I was taking care of when I was a very young nurse, I had just met Zen Master Sung Song and only been living in the Zen Center a very short time, so I was only like 25 years old. And so I was kind of a new nurse, too, in some ways, and a new Zen practitioner. But this job that I was given, it was only going to be for a few days because this man was dying, and I was to spend the night time with him. I was doing private duty nursing because I was working mostly for the Zen Center. Then I would grab a job here and there to make some money. And so I was assigned this patient who was in a coma. And he... before I first went into his room, he's in a coma. He's unconscious. But the nurses in the nurses' station said, "Do you know who that man is?" And I was new to Rhode Island. I didn't know any politics or any news about that place. They said, "That's so-and-so." They gave me some Italian name. They said, "He's the head of the Italian mafia in Rhode Island." You know? And I'm only 25. I know nothing about mafia, or I knew what a mafia was, but I said, okay, you know, innocent. I'm innocent. He's in a coma. He's not going to hurt me, right? And his family's at home. Nobody's around. All of his friends and family are sleeping because it's after 11 p.m. It's midnight shift I was doing. So I went in there, and my karma is I go to bed early. I've always been a morning person, wake up really early, and then by 9, 10 o'clock, I'm very tired. I've always been like that since a child. So I'm working, it's already 11 o'clock. I've been up all day. I'm like, I'm so tired. And it was like the 8 hours that I was sitting with this man in a coma was like 15 hours. It was awful. So I came back to the Zen Center that morning, and Zen Master Sun Kung said, oh, how was your night? I said, it was awful. I couldn't stay awake. And I'm being paid money. I have to sit there and stay awake and attend to his needs. And he didn't need anything, you know. I kept him clean. I mean, I would keep him clean and turn him. You're supposed to turn someone every 2 hours, so I would try to turn him a little bit. But he was so sick, he had this huge stomach from drinking, you know, a cirrhosis. So you couldn't really turn him. He couldn't breathe if you turned him. So anyways, Zen Master Sun Kung said, he'd already taught me to do the dharani, just this shim yujin gode dharani namara dana dharaya. If you do it in your head, you don't sing it. You just repeat it, the words. So he said, you tonight, just do the dharani all night. You'd be practicing and helping him too. You stay awake. So I sat on the edge of the chair that night with my feet on the floor, my hands in my lap, and in my mind, not out loud at all. Not out loud, because that would just, you know, that's intrusive. You know, nothing's worse than someone's dying and somebody, like, let's say some Christian, religious Christian comes in and starts, you know, reading the Lord's Prayer or singing some Christian song, and this person was an atheist or agnostic, or they don't want to hear it, you know. So I wouldn't have said a Buddhist chant out loud in the hospital, but inside I'm just shim yujin gode dharani namara dana dharaya, you know, and it wasn't long, 5, 10, 15 minutes, I don't know how long it was that I was doing this. This man had been in a coma for like 3 days. All of a sudden, he sat up in the bed. This is a true story. He sat up in the bed. He looked over at me. He knew I was over on his left side. He looked to the left. He said, I don't know what you're doing, but stop it. That's out of a coma, he said. As clear as a bell, like, I don't know what you're doing, but stop. I was like, you know. So I stopped it. You know, I stopped it, and I'm back to just, you know. He's back in the coma, I'm back sleeping, you know. It was an amazing experience. And so, you know, I came home. Zen Master says, how was your night? I told him what happened. He said, laughing, he said, demons do not like the dharani. They hate the dharani. It scares them, you know. I should have kept doing it. You know? See what happened, you know. He scared me. I don't know what you're doing, but stop it. I was like, maybe he had a gun under the sheets. So. But that's powerful. But you know, just what Kathy was saying, it's mantra is very powerful. You don't want to be the power. You don't want to think, oh, I'm powerful, I'm doing a mantra. That's already, you kill the mantra. But if you do the mantra from don't know, you do the mantra from I want to ground, I want to understand myself. And so instead of forgetting, the mantra kind of, it just displaces, as if you put, if I put this object in a sink of water, it would displace this much water. It would move over the water. It just, so mantra moves over the thinking. It doesn't shoot it. It doesn't judge it. It doesn't point a finger at it. It just moves it over. And if you don't feed a habit, you don't feed a thinking habit, it will fade. That you keep what's precious, and what isn't precious, it becomes ether. It displaces. It disappears. So because it came from our thinking, we made it. So again, we have to, this is very psychological. It's, you know, in psychology, you have to own your problems. You can't blame your mother. You know, ultimately, you have to own your pain. You have to own your thinking. You have to just not even accept it, embrace it. This is mine. I created this thinking. I created this life. What am I? And if you, any false ideas, if you push them over with sound, with mantra, or with what is this, they go away because you're not feeding the demon. You know, it's like smoking. I smoked for 2 years when I was in college, and when I quit smoking, I quit smoking when I was 21. So only 2 years of smoking. I quit because I saw these autopsies of how black the lungs were, and they were just beginning. This is like 1968, just beginning to say, "Oh, smoking's not good for you." You know, it was so obvious it wasn't good for you, but they're really scientifically proving that smoking isn't good for you. So I quit smoking, and so about 2 months after I quit smoking, or even it lasted probably 3 or 4 months, I mostly smoked when I studied. And so I'd be studying, and this hand is looking for the cigarette. You know, it's an addiction. You know, it's an addiction. So I pull my hand. There's no cigarettes in this room. You know, you cannot smoke. And after a while, it went away. Now they repulse me. Cigarettes make me, I can't stand the smell. And my father died from smoking. I know so many people that died from smoking that I took care of in hospice. So I'm like, it's like real. I would never smoke another cigarette now because my mind's like, no, thank you. But this is the kind of thing you start to drop your demons. You drop your addictions, your habits, anything that's not helpful, and anything that's precious, anything that's compassionate, anything that's creative, your true self, that will just have more space. You know, you'll be more intuitive, more compassionate, wiser, because you're not wasting this energy on these things that aren't helpful. So don't worry about becoming a zombie when you do mantra, but you actually will feel better. It's amazing. So, and you know, a great time to do mantra is when you're on, this isn't just a mantra lecture, but it is helpful, especially for all of us. You know, is when you, if you start to feel tight inside, or you start to feel angry or repulsed or impatient or any kind of negative state, what I do, I just start going, kwan sen bo, inside, not outside, kwan sen bo. It's like taking 10 breaths, like counting to 10. You know, it's very simple. Oh, if you're getting angry, just count to 10. Bring your energy down, and then you'll handle it much more clearly. And kwan sen bo so like is like that, or anything. Coca-Cola is like that. You know, you just calm yourself down. Don't grab your attachments, but just watch them and let it go, and then you're much more skillful after that. Much more skillful. You don't make bad karma. You make good karma. You know, make no karma is even better. You know, you just don't grab it. Don't attach to it. That's very hard to do. I still have to kick into mantra very often because things get difficult. So, any other questions? Yes.
Master Jam, sorry, just now back to your earlier story about the butcher killing the cow. The last point you say when he get the enlightenment is when he hear the sound when the last killing that he do. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what is the enlightenment that he get? Is it he stop killing the cow, or he say I end the suffering, I don't want to kill anymore? Because I want to know the story end where, the enlightenment, what did he get? Sorry, because I'm a bit lost on the last part.
That doesn't matter. Okay. He found his wisdom. He found his freedom. I don't know what he did. That's not important. He might have kept helping his father kill the cows. I have no idea. Okay. But what are you doing just now? That's what's important. If I got enlightenment, what would I do? That's just an idea. But you, again, you have to embrace your own life, embrace your own enlightenment. Like, not enlightenment, but embrace your own question. And what would I do? What you know? But really, it's what am I doing just now? And own that. Pay attention. And if what we're doing isn't so clear, it'll be like an orange light flashing at us. Like, oh, maybe I shouldn't, you know, this isn't so healthy. You know, when we were just now resting before the talk, in our room, there's these two big cans of cookies. You know, just full of cookies, all different little, you know, I love Asia because in Asia, every part of Asia I've been in, all these little snacks, you know. And they're always very doable. They're small. These little small snacks. It's amazing. We don't have that. We have big snacks in America, you know. But nothing. It's a little packaging, it's everything. So I'm looking. I love cookies. That's my favorite dessert. So I like cookies. So I was like, Maybe I'll have a cookie, you know. Then I go, my clear mind goes, I don't need a cookie, you know. I look at food, I get fat, so I can't, it's not good for me to have a cookie. And so it's a little battle inside. Not, I didn't lose any sleep. I slept instead of having a cookie. But it's like, but that's my, that even tonight I'm practicing. I'm like, no, you want cookie, but you don't need cookie. You know, it's a simple little thing. But, you know, think I'm an enlightened Zen master. I still have these little problems, you know. To have a cookie or not to have a cookie, you know. Oh. But your true self knows, you know, your stomach knows, your true self knows. Well, I don't think so. And you can hear that part better, you know, than the, I want it. This part has much more power, you know. So you don't have to get another teacher to tell you what's right and what's wrong. You ask the question, you pay attention, and you feel which one has more power. You already know. We all already understand. So it just takes infinite time to do it, that's all. But you know, again, Kathy mentioned the vow and the direction. You know, this vow to come back over, and this Mahayana vow to come back over and over and over again to help this world. That's a beautiful thing, you know. And it's like, does that ring true to you? Is that possible that every time I could just keep not grabbing that cookie or just being more kind and just trust that as your infinite job? And you just grow. And that's the best thing, is to grow and to learn your lessons. We all can do that. Any other questions?
Hi. So my question is, actually right now, and like really close to me, I have someone who is a little bit sort of like in a lot of emotional suffering. And when I'm close to that person, like, I try to help, but in the end, what happens is I get end up pulled down with that person. Mm-hmm. So I would like to know, is there any way that I can help myself and then maybe help this person, or help that person help herself? Because I've been trying a lot of things, but it's not really working.
Yeah. Don't try to help it. I mean, don't try to help in a sense of I'm helping them. You know, I want to help them. It's more like, what is this? How is it just now? And you know, ultimately, most of us need to help ourselves. And so what people need the most, and that's what this lecture is about, is sound listening, is you just listen to this person. You know, just listen clearly. You don't give good advice. Just listen. And, you know, this reflective listening, like, oh, I feel like my life is over, this person says. Oh, and you say, oh, you feel like your life is over. It's not a game. You're just genuinely just reflecting that you heard them. And then they love that. It's like, yeah, you understand. I feel like my life is over. And then, you know, oh, that I'm so sorry you're so sad. But don't try to help them. Just listen to them. And then if they actually want some advice, well, do you think I should see a therapist maybe? If they ask you, then, well, maybe that would help, you know. But don't say, I think you should see a therapist. People don't like to hear that, you know. But it really is that skillful listening. And then, as I said earlier, your intuition, your grounding place, your listening place will actually guide you, just as that plane with the radar will guide you to back up or move in closer or just be silent, you know, or just say, is there anything more you'd like to say? Talk to me, you know, just encourage that warmth and that communication. And your intuition, you might just say the right thing at some point. But if we're straining to see how can I help, it usually isn't helpful, you know. So same thing with our own personal practice. We don't want to strain, you know, will I ever get enlightenment? You know, that's an idea. But if you ask, what is enlightenment? How is it just now? Then you're wide open to receive the teachings. And I think the universe is very generous. It's amazing. The older I get, the more I can see examples in my life is that it happened, that how generous the world is. So the image of 10,000 hands, 10,000 eyes, Also we say great love, great sadness, that the bodhisattva has the greatest love and also the greatest sadness. The awareness of the pain makes one sad. Do you have the courage to feel that sadness? Do you have the courage to look at that sadness? And if you're able to look and feel and be with that sadness, then again, automatically your intuition, your compassion will bring out the love. So, and we all are different people, so we can't use somebody else for a model. We have to find our own way, you know, our own way. Any other questions?
Yes, I have one. Why is it this koan plays such an important part in Zen Buddhism? And does koan enlighten a lay person who doesn't have insight or wisdom?
Everybody is capable of insight and wisdom. Everybody. Everybody. People act like in an emergency. Someone becomes an incredible hero because of a koan. Like recently, you know, we have a lot of shootings. I'm sure you hear about the shootings in America. It's terrible. It's terrible. And just in the past month, there's been 2 or 3 high school shootings. It's getting so, it's awful. And the last 2 school shootings, with each shooting, one of the students got up and took the shot and knocked the shooter over, and then somebody else could grab the gun. Two young men, you know, just 17, 13 years old, young, but they had that ability to just run at it and stop it. It's called, you know, self-sacrifice, but in there's no self in that moment. You know, there's only the attentiveness of, I have to stop this, you know. Or stop, not even I have to stop this, but stop this. And then they find that ability to run at that. So the koans are like artificial events. You know, they're very brilliant. The people that wrote the koans, I have so much gratitude. You know, a lot of the koans were written by the Chinese. And, you know, not that long ago, you know, the system's been going on for what, 500 years, or I don't know how many, but not that long. But some teacher noticed that when someone was posed with a question like, where do you come from, or what am I, the student would get confused, stop thinking, then the teacher would shout, come back when you know the answer, something like that. That's how the koan system started. And then, you know, this one story, the student left for like 6 years. Where do I come from? It grabbed him. Oh, the Zen master knows where I came from, but I don't know where I came from. Some idea like that. But it boiled down to this attentiveness, where do I come from? And he wouldn't sit there all day with that question. He would get up and help the monastery and do his work and laugh and play and eat and sleep. But underneath all the time, where do I come from was there, that koan. So, in our school, we teach, it's Zen Master Sung San's technique. I think other teachers have done it as well. I don't know, but when I first started training with him, he asked me, like, what is Buddha? And then I have no idea. I'm like, you're asking me. I'm looking around. I have no idea what Buddha is, you know. And he's like, but just for him to ask me was very empowering. Like, he thinks I have the answer. I'm like, I don't know, you know. And he's like, no, what is Buddha? And then he taught me this technique of primary point, of just marking the moment. So instead of thinking, you mark the moment with something. You know, you could go, huh, or just, you know, or snap your fingers, just do something, clap your hand. It's called before thinking. So you teach your mind to hear the question, and before it thinks, just mark the moment with like a hit. You know, that's the technique we use in our school. And a very, something I find amazing is that, you know, people, ordinary people, like, you know, they need their car keys, and they, like, say it's a housewife, it's a mother that has a couple of children. She has to get them to school on time, then she has to be at work to be at a meeting on time. So it's essential that she leaves on time from the house, but she can't find her keys. So people automatically, in any country, I have to put down the thing, but like where are my keys? And that's the primary point. Before they think, they have to ground. If you panic, where's my keys? You're not going to find them. It's impossible. You're panicking. I'm going to be late. Oh, my God. That's not clear thinking. But if you, where are they? Before you think, then you remember you left them in the other room or you put them in the drawer or whatever. It's. I bet everybody in this room has done that where they just, you have to mark the moment. Before thinking. And so that's how we train people to do koan. So Zen Master Sung Sung taught me this. He asked me, what is Buddha? He had to teach me, teach me this. And I said, what? He goes, I ask you what is Buddha and you do this. It was like, 101 Buddhism, So I went, why do I do this? He goes, just do it, just do it. And so the first time, so he asked me again, I'm going to ask you again, and you do this. He's like telling me what to do, So he asked me, what is Buddha? I do this. Oh, wonderful! I felt like I just, got Phi Beta Kappa degree. And I was like, he was so proud of me. Wonderful! I was like, wow, that was great. And then I leave, he rings the bell, I leave, Next time I see him, he was giving us interviews every morning. Oh, good morning, Bobby. Good morning. Good to see you. Very positive. What is Buddha? Oh, wonderful! Yeah. Great Zen student. You, unbelievable. He's like, good job, I'm like, all right. So I was like a trained monkey, really, It really wasn't cutting off my thinking. I wanted the reward, I'm going to hit, and he's going to tell me I'm wonderful, But after a while, I got it. I got that this was cutting off my thinking. He taught us. He talked to us every night. He would explain how before you think, and you can do it. And it's just like learning a tennis serve or something. You have to practice that serve over and over and over again. And then you begin, your body starts to memorize how to best do this. And it's all, it has to be before thinking. You can't be worried. You have to just do it. So after, 5-6 interviews where he's telling me how wonderful I am, then he says, what is Buddha? I go, no good. He goes, one more step is necessary. And then it becomes, oh, what do you mean one more step? What is that? And that you take that back to your cushion. That's if you are training with a teacher. It's wonderful because, I walked around. I was working on that for a long time. Like, how do I answer what is Buddha after the hit? So then progressively, there's lots of koans. But more than anything, better than anything else, I learned that all the koans I had at work, the koans I had with my family, with my relationship with the sangha, lots of koans. Like, do I say something? Do I not say something? Do I do this? Do I do that? I began to learn how much that helped. You don't have to have the answer immediately. You listen to your true self. You listen to your don't know. And everybody in this room has the same don't know mind. Everybody. That's the amazing thing. So you learn to value that not knowing mind, that centered mind, and just trust it and not have a clock. Like, don't be impatient. Like, well, so-and-so, is clearer than I am, or this one passes Cohen and I can't. Like, it's dangerous, It can be very, very competitive, but that loses the whole point. The point is your questioning, your job, your effort, Does that help?
Yes, thank you. I have two more questions, a short one. Who are you and where do you come from?
I am drinking water because I am thirsty. Now that was effortless, right? I have to just answer you what I'm doing just now. It's not special. I'm not some special. There's not an individual here. There's effort. There's training. There's But ultimately, it's just standing here talking to you, drinking water. That's it. And then you just, imagine you're a neurosurgeon, you're doing a brain, you're trying to remove a tumor from a young person's brain and it's wrapped around an artery or something, and you want to help them, you want to save their life. Then you have to be very meticulous. You can't think about your golf game on the weekend or a fight you had with your wife in the morning, or you're only looking at that tissue, that brain tissue, only that. And so in that moment, that surgeon is just that. You hope he is. That's what you need, not somebody who's distracted. So it just goes moment to moment to moment like that. Any other questions?
Amitabha, Master. I would like to ask if we are doing sound or hearing meditation, is it necessarily depending on the external sound object, or is there any way that we can depend on the sound object that have been converted into mind objects in that sense, rather than attaching to the external objects?
Definitely, as I said earlier, it's having the question and having, I haven't mentioned faith, but having faith that centering your mind and coming back to this moment, if you really begin to have some faith in that that's it, whether it's good day, bad day, doesn't matter, whether there's sound, there's no sound, doesn't matter, it's really, how is it just now? And training that way. There's a kind of a made up koan, and someone asked me once, they said, you're visiting, because I was a nurse, he said, you're visiting a patient and the patient is, they cannot hear, they cannot see, they cannot feel, they're in a deep coma. Just maybe they've been burned all over the body, so if you touch their body, they can't feel it, they can't hear anything. They're gone, They're not gone because they're not a coma. That's the wrong image. This person's deaf, blind, and they can't feel anything. So how do you help this person? How do you help them? But that, you can love them. You can do Kwansan Bosal. You can do anything to send them support, which is always vital, very wonderful thing. But ultimately, that person inside that brain has to have a practice, Imagine you can't hear, you can't see, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch. Then what are you? But you are something. You're perfectly capable if you've trained. So sound's not always essential. Is that kind of your question? Is that what you were asking? Okay, yeah. External stuff. It means you need your question, you need your vow, your belief in yourself, and some idea of how to train, And it doesn't have to be this training. It could be anything that works for you. But ultimately, it's all Zen if you're just doing it. Zen is like really the wrong word, because that means, in Japanese, it means to sit. But it's really, it's all, what is this? Anywhere and everywhere, no matter what religion. Mother Teresa was extremely popular in this world, and she passed away within the last 10 years sometime. And apparently she had a breach of faith towards the end, and she even wrote about it in her diaries. She just started to question some of the teachings, the Catholic teachings. And she was actually depressed. Apparently, I haven't read it very closely, but she was having some struggles, the last 6 months or 2 years of her life, really questioning things. And I heard about that, and I didn't say it. Just to myself, I said, well, good for you. Good for you to doubt some of teachings that weren't your own experience, some dogma or something that might not have been really valuable. She started to just want to, she was so kind. I mean, she worked really hard her whole life, and all of a sudden she's depressed and doubting Catholicism or something. I don't know how she would have worded it, but having a breach of her faith. And I thought that was very high class, really, for her to question like that. It's not a bad thing to be depressed or to question. It's like because you're not accepting some storyline. All of a sudden you're really asking, what's the truth? So that's all you need to do. And there's some great help out there, you know. Any other questions?
Last question, please.
I don't have a clock, so I'm like totally have no idea what time it is. So,
my question is, because sometimes I tend to hurt people by saying the wrong thing, but it's unintentional. So,
I do that too, by the way. Yeah, that's quick to speak, you know.
Yeah. How do I prevent saying the wrong thing? Because I've try to think twice, but sometimes I just say it on impulse.
Well, the first thing I do is apologize. You know, after it happens, own it. Own what you did. It's very nice for people. It's so healing to say, even if it's a week later, but I feel like I said something. I might have stepped on your toes. I might have, insulted you in some way. And just to say you're sorry. And then, as you said, you just think twice next time we have a saying, keep the stopper in the bottle. We had some students in the Zen Center, Sansini would make them put a sign around their neck. It said silence. their speech was making a lot of trouble. And it was like we respected them. He made them wear it. It really wasn't making them feel guilty. I think they kind of liked they got the attention from Sansini and that, you know, anyway, they'd wear the sign silence for a week, and so if they started to say something, we'd point to the sign, and all of them reported how much they learned from that. Like, wow, if you don't say anything and you just listen, there's all kinds of stuff you're missing because you're so quick to throw out, look at me, look at, you know, I got this to say, I have this to say, and I. And so, it's a sign of a maturity to just, it's great that you kind of recognize and that might be a trait you have. You know, how old are you? 15? I didn't know I had that trait until I was like 35. I thought I was just right, you know. All of a sudden people say, Bobby, you know, sometimes we're in a meeting and you take over. You know, you don't listen to us. And it was like this kind of karma of just being quick to raise your hand and quick to speak. So 15, that's no problem, okay? It's nice that you've noticed that. That's wonderful, yeah. Give her a hand, yeah. So again, it's not about not making mistakes. It's about noticing your mistakes and then just switch it, okay? So thank you very much again for inviting us to Guadalupe, and we're happy to be here.
I hope that all of us have learned something from today's talk. Before we end, I would like to ask a Zen Master to lead us to transfer merit. Is it okay?
In English?
Yes.
Okay, everybody stand. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. Delusions are endless. We vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite. We vow to learn them all. The Buddha way is inconceivable. We vow to attain it.
Please stand facing the hall. Yeah. Okay. I think that's the end for today. Thank you for coming. It's a big crowd today, And is there any next year, anything? You want to make any announcement tomorrow
there is also a talk by Zen Master Siong Hyang at Hobing Buddhist Temple at Kuala Lumpur. The talk will start at 8 tomorrow evening. So if you have the time, do make yourself available and join us tomorrow. Thank you.
Tomorrow is a dialogue in Hobing. Okay, thank you everyone. And have a safe night.